I was just in Chicago for a seminary class on liberal theology, for which I read some of Ruff, Waldo Emerson's sermons. And I think it's a little unfair for a mere seminarian to have to preach right after Ruff, but I'll do my best. As Ruff said, the Welcoming Congregation program helped us learn how to undo homophobia and make our congregation more welcoming for those among us who are lesbian, gay, and bisexual. Our congregation isn't perfect, and we have more work to do around being welcoming to those among us who are trans and gender nonconforming, but we did a lot. We became a welcoming congregation. And the fact that we did do it, that we needed to do it, reminds us that before we became a welcoming congregation, there was a problem. There's a lot to be proud of in our heritage, in our denomination. UUs have a history of working at the forefront of issues like marriage equality. And yet, there was a time before the 70s and 80s when UU churches were not welcoming to LGB people, when we had a problem with homophobia. And that's the reason we had to do the work of becoming a welcoming congregation and not just support the cause of marriage equality outside of our congregation. As Unitarian Universalists, we have done well, but we are always reaching for more love, more justice. To be human is both to have a godlike potential to do good and also to have a shadow side that we sometimes don't want to acknowledge. To be Unitarian Universalist is to fight for justice in our world and also to confront the injustice inside of us. This is true for oppression based on gender, based on race, based on sexual orientation, ability, and many other identities. Today, I would like to share some of my own experiences of realizing that I have failed to treat Black people with inherent dignity and worth, and what I have learned from these confrontations with my own shadow side. I grew up in an upper middle class suburb of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, that was predominantly white with a few Asian Americans, but very few Black or Latinx people. I learned from what my parents, church leaders, and teachers said that racism had ended by the civil rights movement, except perhaps in some far-flung rural areas. But I learned more subtly that while Black and white people were equal, the poor Black people in the inner city were lazy and dangerous. In late high school, I took an excellent US history course that started me questioning these beliefs and noticing the conflict between them. I learned more about how awful slavery had been and how race-based slavery was an invention of the upper class to keep poor whites and Blacks from working together. I also noticed just how few Black people I actually interacted with in my daily life and how I felt uncomfortable when I passed Black students in the hallway who I didn't know. Why did I feel so uncomfortable? Shouldn't race not matter anymore? What was wrong with me? I didn't know what to do. I didn't even have the words to express what I was experiencing. After high school, I went to Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan, which is here. And every year at Calvin, there was 1 week called Unlearn Week, during which students were encouraged to go to lectures and workshops about unlearning racism. Speakers of color at these workshops talked about the ways that racism still affected their lives, and white speakers admitted that they were recovering racists. At first, I was really skeptical about using the term racism. Most dictionaries define racism as something like the belief that all members of each race possess characteristics or abilities specific to that race, especially so as to distinguish it as inferior or superior to another race or races. Well, I mean, I believe that people of all different races were basically the same, so how could I be racist? Racists were people who used the N-word and didn't want their daughters to marry a black person. But one unlearned week speaker said that what she actually meant when she said racism was something else. Racism to her was prejudice plus power. And it didn't work so much on a personal level as much as at an institutional level. Prejudice didn't mean that you personally thought that people of a different race were inferior, but that you, and many people like you, treated them differently, often unintentionally. I started to notice that none of my close friends at school were people of color. How had that happened? I hadn't set out intending to make only white friends, and there were many people of color at my college. I must have made less of an effort to make friends with people of color without realizing it. Apparently, I was prejudiced. But what about power? Did I really have power just because I was a white person? Wasn't I just a poor college student? Then I started thinking about how many authority figures in my life were white. Almost all of them. My professors, my high school teachers, my pastors, my representatives, every single president of the United States except one. How would that have felt if I had been black? Even if I didn't have a lot of power on my own, it did seem like white people had more than their fair share of power in society. And since people could be prejudiced unintentionally, it seemed likely that all of these powerful white people in my life might accidentally treat me a bit better because I was white. And over time, all these little things would add up, and this was what those unlearn week people meant when they talked about white privilege. Part of me wished that we could just pick a new word that could mean prejudice plus power instead of using racism, which is a word that is so charged. But eventually, I started to feel more comfortable with saying that racism is still alive and well in our country, although it is more subtle, and that I, too, was a recovering racist. After college, I started going to a predominantly white church in a low-income, predominantly black and Latinx neighborhood. I helped to lead this church program in which neighborhood families could come and eat dinner together, and then the kids would go to homework help, and the adults would go to like a parents' support group. And another church that was in the same neighborhood as my church that was predominantly black partnered with our church to run the program. And after the first semester of the program ended, we got all the volunteers together for a feedback session to discuss what had gone well and what we wanted to improve for the next semester. I thought the feedback session had been a huge success, but when I got back together with the leaders from the other church, these two black women expressed frustration about the racist comments that the volunteers from my church had made about what the black families in the program needed. For example, they implied that black children didn't know how to set the table, and so they needed to practice. I was so hurt that they thought that my friends from church had said racist things, and I tried to explain to them that their intention behind their comments had been good. But they didn't seem to listen to me. They seemed so angry, and I got upset, and I started crying, and my friend who was in the room like came over and put his arm around me protectively. And about a year later, I came across an article online about white women's tears. The article described a situation in which a white woman had unintentionally said something racist to a black woman. And when the black woman pointed it out, the white woman started crying and got the sympathy of everyone in the room, while the black woman was chided by the others for being mean and angry. And according to this article, this is actually a common pattern. As soon as a white woman starts crying, the white woman who's actually in the wrong gets comforted, while the person of color who is actually being harmed gets no sympathy at all, causing more harm to them. I had played right into the white woman's tears pattern. These black church leaders had to sit in a room and listen to all these white volunteers say things about black families that were hurtful to them. And when they told me so, I perceived them as angry and mean. My friend acted as though I were the one who needed protection. And despite our good intent, the impact was to say that my emotions as a white woman were far more important and legitimate than their emotions as black women. Confronting my own shadow side in moments like this is much, much harder to do than standing against injustice out there. I want to see myself as a person who helps others and fights injustice, not as someone who hurts others and perpetrates injustice. It is almost a physically painful blow to my self-image to realize that I have hurt someone else, that I have had a racist impact. I am tempted to ignore the injustice or to act as though I am the victim of the person who brings me this pain of self-reflection. But sometimes, pain is necessary for growth. I wish I had seen at the time that what these church leaders were telling me about the racist impact of the white volunteer suggestions was not an attack, but a gift of perspective and of trust. They surely knew that as a white person, I was unlikely to react well when they pointed out an incident of racism. They could have just silently stopped working with our church. And yet they chose to confront me directly about it anyway and try to teach me something that I needed to know. I am thankful to them for taking the risk, and I am sorry that I broke the trust that they offered. What they said did eventually teach me. They taught me about the difference between intention and impact. Even with good intentions, I sometimes harm other people. And failing to accept the harm that I have done only causes more harm. They taught me that the best thing I can do is accept that I have caused harm and try not to make the same mistake in the future. As I continued my learning about racism online and through my classes at my seminary, Meadville Lombard, I started encountering this new term that confused me, white supremacy culture. Aren't white supremacists people who wear pointed hats and burn crosses? I mean, come on, people. I finally got on board with using the word racism to mean prejudice plus power. Now you have to redefine white supremacy too? What do you even mean by that? But the more that I read and thought about it, the more sense that it actually made to me to use this term. More than racism, white supremacy culture allows us to name what is really going on. Oppression based on race in our country is not symmetrical. Whiteness, the way that people view the things and do things in North American, Western European culture, whiteness in our society is considered normal. Anything else is deviant or at best exotic. White people talk about missing out on having an ethnic heritage because we have been trained to see our own culture as not one among many, but as the baseline against which other cultures are measured. This assumption that whiteness is normal is everywhere in our institutions. It's in the Unitarian Universalist Association. It's in me, and it's in our church. It's not the fault of individual white people, but it is the responsibility of white people to try to improve. It hurts those among us who are people of color. It separates us from each other, and ultimately, it is destructive for white people too. White supremacy culture is not an intention or an opinion, so much as a pattern of acting, a habit that is slow and hard to break or even to notice. As I was trying to grapple with what white supremacy culture meant, I found a list of attributes of white supremacy culture that I found very helpful. Here are some of the attributes that I have noticed in my encounter I told you about with the Black church leaders. Perfectionism, that made it hard to admit that I had made a mistake. Defensiveness, that made it hard for the church leaders to share new and challenging ideas with me. Either-or thinking, that made it hard for me not to think of our conflict in terms of us, them, right, wrong. Objectivity, that valued the logical explanation for why the suggestions were not racist and dismissed the emotional response of the church leaders to those suggestions. Fear of open conflict, that made it seem rude or mean for the church leaders to confront me with the issue directly. Do you recognize any of these in yourself or in our church? Perfectionism, defensiveness, either-or thinking, objectivity, fear of open conflict? I'm not saying that all white people are white supremacists, but that white supremacy culture permeates our society. White supremacy culture is the water we're swimming in. It's hard to notice it without an outside perspective, and it's impossible not to perpetuate it unless we actively try to work against it. Just like the UUs and others in Charlottesville who confronted the white supremacists recently, we need to confront white supremacy culture in our institutions and in our hearts. And we need to seek healing and a new way of being together. I know that this term comes with a lot of baggage, but even if you don't like the phrase white supremacy culture, this is the term that's being used in a larger conversation in our country and in our denomination. At General Assembly last year, the major topic of the week was the way that white supremacy culture plays into hiring decisions and many other aspects of our denomination and how we can get rid of it. Black Lives of Unitarian Universalism has made several asks to congregations across the country to talk about white supremacy culture and to put their learning into action. We need to talk about white supremacy culture and about race, which of course is far more complicated than just the black and white dynamics I shared in my story this morning. These are difficult and painful conversations, but I believe that our community here is strong enough and loving enough to hold them. We will have opportunities to try these sorts of conversations in the future, and I challenge those of you who are white in particular to take advantage of these opportunities. Let us be thankful for pain that leads to growth. Let us make room for ourselves and for others to make mistakes and to try again. Let us continue to strive for justice both in our world and in ourselves. Let us seek healing and wholeness. And let us continue to live into the heart of our tradition as Unitarian Universalists. A tradition of questioning what we thought was true, a tradition of welcoming people whose society has marginalized, a tradition of seeking personal and societal transformation, and even a tradition of redefining words. Blessed be.